Just some, again, I'm picking up details. If you want to focus on something else, holler. On this idea of the dissent and ambiguity. Be sure to take golden cups full of the sweet drink of life. Middle of the page. Remember the sprig in Living Symbol? Take pains to awaken the dead. I think the dead there would be past values. Dig deep mines. If you're going to do it, or don't. Next paragraph, hell is when the depths come to you. He did have a sense of humor, even when he was miserable. Mm-hmm. Middle of that last paragraph, hell is when you must think and feel and do everything that you know you do not want. In the next column, the third paragraph, that is the ambiguity of God. He is born from a dark ambiguity and rises to a bright ambiguity. This ability to live with uncertainty. And where I notice this most directly is with people who are terrified of their negative emotions. They're afraid if they go into them that they'll never stop. Rather than realizing you go into it, you come out of it. I think they're afraid if you go into it, you'll become a bitter old person forever. And that's exactly what produces bitterness, is this undealt with emotion.
And also the fear that you can't control.
You can't control it, and it's not going to stop.
Yeah.
Right, what he's talking about here in this dissent is getting to know the polarity in yourself and realizing one leads to the other. You don't have to be afraid of it.
And the only way out is through.
Only way out's through, yep.
And really, you know, that's the heroic journey. Part of it. I mean, that's what.
I'd say that's the new heroic journey.
Yeah.
Right.
To become less afraid of going to that place.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems, I don't even know what I'm trying to say. Like, we come into the world and it's all this material work.
Uh-huh.
We eat and go through all this stuff.
Yeah.
Is that doing this is a natural progression to get where you want to go? Is that stupid?
No, it's...
Why do we have to break the water?
It's the natural progression to maturity, I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah. But we live in such an immature society that it seems foreign. He talks, I'm skipping a little bit. Nothing is easier than to play at ambiguity. Nothing more difficult than to live it. Again, these are just further reflections on the basic idea. He plays, hides from inner depths. At the end of that paragraph, there's a true love that does not concern itself with neighbors. The next one is kind of not exactly linear. When the hero was slain and the meaning recognized in the absurdity, when all tension came rushing down from gravid clouds, when everything had become cowardly and looked to its own rescue, I became aware of the birth of the god. So that's the new value system. Maybe the next really important part there is that last paragraph, which we've sort of been circling around anyway. I must say that the god could not come into being before the hero had been slain. The hero, as we understand him, has become an enemy of God, since the hero is perfection.
I have a question mark by the paragraph above.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't have anything to say about it.
Oh.
I'm just not sure about it.
Let's look at it.
And thus the image of the ancient is fulfilled.
Yeah.
I pursued my soul to kill it, to kill the child in it. For I am also the worst enemy of my God.
Let's see.
Oh, I think I see what it means now.
Go ahead, tell us.
Okay, I have it there for a second. So, but that's God's decision, he's saying. But I also recognize that my enmity is decided upon in the God. But I don't know what he means by the child in it. He's not referring to that new God image, I don't think.
I don't, that's the problem. He's using the same word differently.
Yeah, that's what confused me.
I think here he means infantility.
Mm-hmm. The childishness.
Childishness. Yeah.
Because up there he talks about, let's see, not playing.
Right, right.
That's what he's referring back
right.
to, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, you, on the other hand, you could say how important play is, but here he means play as like playing at.
Yeah, not being serious.
Not being serious.
Dabbling into.
Dabbling might be another way to put it.
Yeah. And on the other, on the page before, he talks in the footnotes, 136, referring to the serpent up here, but he's talking about how the serpent put an end to childlike magnificence in paradise. And that's what I was referring in my head to the child here.
Is I think so.
Childlike atmosphere of paradise where there's no consciousness.
Yeah. I think that's the big idea, you know, is the slaying of the conquering perfect hero. And the ambiguity of life once that happens, as the means whereby a new value of what's important emerges. And we certainly live in a hero-driven culture. I mean, who makes more money? Peyton Manning or a high school teacher? See what I mean? That's where you see it. And to remember when this was written, before a lot of questioning theologically had occurred. So when he talks about the hero, he's also talking about perfection, which he gets into in 245.
Do we have a deep need as human beings to have a hero? Because it seems like we keep wanting to perpetuate that or to make a hero somehow.
Right.
That's a human in
I guess
psyche.
So. Mm-hmm.
And that needs to die?
That needs to die. That's what I've learned out of this. One of the things I've learned.
Those opposites that you had mentioned last time of idealizing
and belittling.
And belittling.
Well, when you hear somebody idealizing, watch out. You know, that's, I mean, I'm sure you know this, Jane, from your work in business. That's what moves business. There are super managers, and there are guys that they idealize, and there are successful companies, and everybody looks up to them and wants to slap them on the back. It's all idealization. And boy, it makes me nervous.
And that is
the need to have a hero. That's the need to have a hero. And as I said, I think the flip side is the need to have a scapegoat.
And the need to for perfection, is that coming out of the Christian myth that God is perfect?
Well, I think maybe, I don't have enough cross-cultural experience to tell you, but certainly maybe I have a monotheistic religion.
Because growing up Catholic, that's, you know, that was held up as the idea of perfection.
Right.
You could never reach it, but you better damn well try.
Mm-hmm.
50 Hail Mary and 7 Our Fathers and...
No wonder you have customers.
I make half my money from lousy parents and half my money from the church.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many dreams I've seen of people being destroyed by religious images. It's sickening. Buy one, get one free. Well, that's that carries over to the top of 245. At 245, he starts another idea, which those of you who have done Nietzsche will have heard. Again, I think it's something new, and really it's something I'd like to work on, if time permits me, in my life, I mean. What does it mean to be a citizen? You might paraphrase the discussion to be on the second column on 245. And what he's saying is, you have a relationship to the world by virtue of being single in yourself. About the middle of, how many paragraphs? That big first paragraph starting with, we think.
Second column.
First column, 245. See where I am? We think. Mm-hmm. Big paragraph. Go down in that paragraph. 1, 2, 3 lines down. We are single if we are in ourselves, but communal in relation to what is outside us. I think that sums up that discussion. How I think I would put that is, it's by finding your meaning, which is communicated in a central image of value to you. As you serve your meaning, that's how you become a valuable citizen. You don't become a valuable citizen, as one thinks, by looking around and seeing what the community needs. That would be being outside yourself. but by looking inside to what you have to give and then giving it. So if you're a plumber, you know, don't volunteer to build houses. Don't try to be a carpenter. I mean, I'm being facetious a little bit, but or if your gift is carpentry, don't try to plumb houses for Habitat for Humanity. But I think that's what we do. We hear all these valuable causes, and we feel guilty or wanting to contribute. And thus, and so we start with the need, not with what we have to give. So we think that there is signals within us and communality outside of us. Outside of us is the communal in relationship to the external, while singleness refers to us. But, I skipped a little bit, but if we are outside of ourselves, then we are single and selfish in the communal. If you try to give what is needed, that's how I put it, as opposed to what your meaning is to be fulfilled, that actually leads to selfishness. Our self suffers privation if we are outside ourselves.
Where are you exactly again?
That paragraph, we think.
First column?
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
Give that 1, 2, 3, 4, okay.
This in Zarathustra's story is talking about compassion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just what we've been doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you said it's that point at which one's greatest passion makes the world's greatest need.
Who says that?
Buechner, Buechner.
Who's he? She?
Theologian? Yeah.
Presbyterian, I'm sorry. Presbyterian theologian.
So he starts with
same idea.
Your greatest passion makes the world's greatest need, not the world's greatest need, and you figure out.
That's generally how we live. Now, I'm not saying don't give money to the American Cancer Society and so on, but that your basic orientation is through what your meaning is. And I think where your passion and what your meaning is, that's the same thing. Or you could say what your gift is. I think they're all different ways of saying the same thing.
You know what's interesting about that is, you know, when you look at somebody and you hold them up as an icon of one who's deeply given, you don't really know whether or not they are actually in having individuated themselves and are giving. Because the truth of the matter is, we all have a lot of gifts that we can give, and the easy thing sometimes is to go give the gift that's easiest to give.
Also, what you don't know is what their kids think of them. That's where I see it.
Yeah.
He's great. I mean, I've seen some people in this city that are lauded as captains of industry and good guys, and boy, you want them on your board, and their kids hate them because they are selfish SOBs. And all of that is they're fulfilling the image of the great guy.
Our manager has a little sign in her office that says perception is 90% of reality, and I always remind her that it's still the 10% that's going to change her right now.
Yeah, put that, sneak that on the bottom of her sign sometime. Yeah, I mean, it just astounds me. More their wives. But kids generally are more likely to suffer, I think, because the wife can often be seduced into enjoyment of all that success that the kids. Now, the next paragraph, I think he's totally confused. I'm tempted to skip it. He distinguishes God and the self and so on. He reworked that completely.
From the black books, you mean?
From here.
In his later works.
Okay. That, then I think, you know, what he came to is the God image is all we can know. So here he's talking about the distinction between God and the self. And later he's saying, well, we don't know what God is. But we do know what the God image is, and that is the self.
I really like the last two lines of that. So you'll arrive at within yourself, and only through yourself sees in you.
Right.
Because you're in the advancement of your life. This, I had a situation where everyone was seized by the self, and it's something that was totally uncharacteristic, and it moved me forward, but it was a really miserable.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is later he called that self the God image. That's all. It's one and the same. But early on you can kind of hear this, we saw it somewhere else. He distinguishes between self and God.
Nietzsche.
Was that Nietzsche? So this was something he was working on for a long time.
How is that distinguished? Or would you, because that's been something
that's that?
God and self. I mean,
What he came to is we can't know. Mm-hmm. So what we can know is our experience.
Okay. Did he come to a place where he said that God had so much baggage that he then just used self instead of the word God, because we had too much of the God image around the word God?
No. Well, if he did, I'm not aware of it. He might have. But what I'm aware of is that what he came to say was the self and the God image are the same thing. What is God? He says, how would I know? So the way he solves the problem is by saying, there's no way I can answer that question.
God image and the self, he was saying, are the same.
Yeah. In other words, what he's trying to distinguish is experience of God and knowing a metaphysical God. He feels we can't know. We can have an experience of. Mm-hmm. But the question is that experience knowledge of God? He says no, because it's filtered through human perceptual categories.
It's our experience,
yeah.
And that becomes our God image.
When I read this paragraph, I got the idea he was making the distinction between the Atman and Purusha. You know, the piece of God that manifests.
You know, let's see. Maybe that works. Let's see.
The more transcendent aspect.
Well, but look at the first sentence. If we see a God outside of ourselves. If we set a God outside of ourselves, he tears us loose from the self. But see, Purusha, Atman and Brahman are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I steered away from that interpretation of it.
But it's Purusha, and then Atman and Brahman, right?
Oh, I thought
Purusha is that the personal piece.
I thought Atman was the personal piece as well.
In the West, there's a big confusion on that one. The way I was trained, it was a lot of Western writers make that mistake.
Oh, well, I'm making a mistake too.
Well, before you told me that you thought Purusha was the personal piece, so I don't know if you've forgotten something, but
Maybe I was wrong.
I don't know. I mean, I've been trying to see what is said in the West.
I'm not really sure. Why don't you do some research?
I've been doing a bit, and so far people seem very confused. And the Hindus don't really care.
Oh, that's the answer. There's the answer.
So, yeah, I'm going to look a little more, but...
Yeah, I thought Atman and Purusha were, if not the same, the personal manifestation of the cosmic. And Brahman was
Atman
the cosmic.
Atman is Brahman.
Yeah, but Atman is my version of Brahma. That's how I understood. So, in our language, you'd say the self is both personal and collective.
Some texts call equate Atman with spirit and Purusha with soul.
Well, then you're beyond me. Why don't you dig around?
Okay.
I just don't know. Anyone else know? I don't.
I don't know who Purusha. How do you spell Purusha?
P-U-R-U-S-H-A.
We had that in the visions. So I'm not sure they talked about the Purusha a lot in the vision seminar.
Because it wasn't, he never did, okay, because that kind of gets back to combining those two. Self and self, he capital S and small s. He didn't make that distinction.
Jung.
Before, I mean, like, wasn't it Marie von Franz who actually started making that?
So the problem in German is you capitalize all nouns.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Well, then, okay. So it's small s. Well,
so you don't know.
Translated it.
Yeah, that's the problem, is who translated it.
Okay, so but the concept, getting beyond the small, the way it's written, the concept is like the small self would be my personal, better self, for lack of, and then the capital S would be the God image.
I don't think so.
Because the God image appears in the
personal. Okay.
So now, it may be there are writers who write like that, Jane. You could very well come across that. I'm not sure that was Jung's intent. Okay. And the problem is that all selbst, das selbst is always capital, all nouns like das Wasser, water, is capital W. All nouns are capitalized. Not just in titles, but in every word and sentence. So that has added confusion. What would Jung have done?
Yeah.
Maybe he said somewhere what he would have done. If he did, I don't know where it is.
Because, you know, in all the different readings, you know, you see it both ways, and you kind of think, well, should I interpret it?
But remember, that's the translator.
Yeah. I just recently read they made some sort of committee decision on to use this lowercase, and it was independent of what your thought is
in this document.
In the interpretation, the translation of his writings.
I mean, like some Jungian.
Whomever was.
There's an oxymoron for you. Jungian committee. Whatever it decides, I'm sure is BS.
The publishers and the translators.
I think in the collected works it's capital S, but I'll have to check.
I didn't think in the seminar.
Well,
though.
See, the seminars, that was given in English.
Oh.
Orally, and somebody wrote it down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Shorthand. Oh, I was all thinking by shorthand.
Yeah.
So if the... the question would be, what did Jung say about the translations he read of the collected works? If in the collected works it's a capital S consistently, he would have proofread all of that. And that would be the telltale detail.
What about a memory? Use the capital?
I didn't mean to get off on him, but it's like that always comes up.
There's been big arguments about it. I mean, what's his name? The guy in London.
Fordham.
He refused to have anything to do with capitalizing this. But he was a jerk. I would go capital S, but who knows? Meaning, it's a central authority. That's why I would capitalize it.
Beyond unauthorized.
Yeah, beyond.
Would Young's command of English then enough that he would have done?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was darn near perfect. What is it in there, Sandy?
It's the smallest.
No, see, but I wonder about that.
Yeah, right.
Because yeah, and you know, that is not a complete record of memory streams, reflections. That book.
Yeah.
No, there are parts cut out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I asked myself, how much editorial control did he have?
Okay.
You know, you assume, oh, Jung, you know, was Jung and he could call the shots. Mm-hmm. No. Many of these things were taken out of his hands. Like that.
Actually didn't get published until after his death.
And that's right.
And Neil Ujesa.
That's right.
Well, according to Zebra Bear, I don't know. All the ramifications that they went through to get that thing published, it was like, oh my God, it's years.
Yeah.
And Neil Ujesa.
Jaffe.
Went back and forth with the publishers, and they went round and round.
Uh-huh.
Then one publisher left, and another came in. I mean, it's a wonder it ever made it.
Yeah.
So it says recorded and edited by her. So,
yeah.
He didn't even write it.
What would they talk about? It was antified. They referred to as her as a sort of an old aunt. And she antified.
She was a wimp.
I read that somewhere.
Yeah, I didn't know her, but. I didn't see how many balls.
Didn't the family come down on that book and determine a lot of what was in there?
Did they?
Yes.
I'll look in the collected works. Just curious what's in there. I've never, you know, I paid attention to it and I've forgotten what I figured out.
I thought I'd seen it both ways.
It might be both ways.
But I'm not sure.
I don't know. In any case, to me, what this smacked of was this distinction between God and the self, and that's something he never makes later on. The self is the God image, is personal, is collective. It's all of those things. Then the next paragraph, the hero, what he turns to again is this idea of the effect of the hero, in that he elicits imitation. And, you know, again, I think we can critique some of what he says here as well, because what I wanted to say to Jung here is what Jung said to Nietzsche in the Zarathustra seminars. Jung, do you really think the average person is going to understand this? He talks about Nietzsche that way, that Nietzsche presents this portrait of the future human being, and Jung saying, no one's ever going to understand this. And, in other words, I'm not sure imitation is that bad. Can a society exist without imitation? For those on the path of inner work, you might say, yes, then it becomes important. And the temptation to imitate is very destructive.
Imitation would give security, safety.
You don't have to think as much.
Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's a polarity. There are times when it's the right thing to do, and there are times when it's not.
Mm, yeah.
Imitation is how you learn. You can't learn something
exactly
without imitating
yeah
it.
And can everyone in the society, you know, be in Jungian analysis?
Yeah.
I kind of doubt it.
Although if that's the new God image that we're working for, at some point would it take over as the collective and, you know, everyone
yeah.
was involved in some religious aspect at one time, but not everybody was a priest. So would there be at least some
big questions? I don't know. I just raised that for the sake of argument. Well, the last paragraph is back to the war. Cold of outer space will spread across the earth. Remember his dreams of the frozen Europe. And God will step between men and drive every individual with the whip of icy cold to the warmth of his own monastic heart. So, see, what he's saying here is that war was God. Why does that get people upset? The coldness of God not having been recognized took over. What we can learn from it is the importance of warmth. So in that sense, what we went through in those wars was to become aware of our own coldness and seek human relatedness. And I think to some extent, the fact the world has not blown itself up yet is proof of that.
It's interesting that it's portrayed as something evil coming down from outer space.
Uh-huh.
How old is that image? Do you have no idea? That idea of something sort of coming down. And
I know, though.
In a lot of ancient cultures.
I was just wondering if it was something more recent, a more recent sort of imagery. Well,
I mean, like the gods of Olympus looking it down.
I don't know. This sort of idea of outer space and
well, probably as old as civilization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you think of Gilgamesh epic. And the causing of the flood.
I guess I'm thinking there's sort of a new little twist here because
outer space.
Outer space isn't necessarily heavenly wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, but well, actually, yes.
But then the Olympians weren't all heavenly wonderfulness, but they were on a mountain. So.
All the, many of the furthermore primal tribes have worshipped meteorites.
Mm-hmm.
So there you probably have it.
Mm-hmm. But those were considered benevolent.
I don't know about that.
Maybe just the ones that I read about anyway.
Gary, what's the difference? Like, you know, earlier we had the image of going into the desert. And now we have the image of, you know, the cold as the last. Are those kinds of prevalent or different?
Yes, I think they are. Maybe the cold blast indicates the destructiveness of the desert experience. Because that coldness would be the coldness of the Nazis. Just slaughtering. Okay, top of 245. He turns to selfish desire. And if I've got him right, he's saying that's not a bad place to start. Because it's when you turn that inwards that it becomes the interest to your unconscious, which leads to the self. In other words, you can't do individual work if you don't feel you're worth something. You can't do individual work if you don't desire anything. So the desire for self-knowledge can start in a desire for whatever. Again, you could hear Nietzsche in this, I think.
You talk about neurosis as the beginning of...
Or neurosis as the beginning of consciousness. Here's another paradoxical sentence. The third paragraph, second column, 245. If you are in your solitude, and all the space around you has become cold and unending, then you have moved far from men, and at the same time, you have come near to them as never before.
Huge question mark there.
What is he saying?
I felt he was saying that when you do the inner journey towards individuation and you come to that place of emptiness, you come to that place of nothingness, you've moved very far away from men, but because of that, you will be able to relate to the average... That's where I went with it. I don't know. I'm not.
Yeah, not bad. Any other shots?
I thought this relates back to what he was saying about the outer God earlier, where if you have this God that you've projected out, and so everything is just external, and now that projection is gone, and you are left solely with yourself, all of a sudden, what used to fill up the space now is a big void.
Mm-hmm.
There's not this God out there, there's
mm-hmm.
no place there.
Mm-hmm.
There's just this emptiness and it's this wholeness, and it feels like it just goes on forever. It's like, you know, there's this sense of living in this void. So you feel like you've moved out of life, away from life, certainly life as you knew it. But the more you do that and the deeper you get into yourself, the closer then you begin to truly move forward. Because now you're not in the sense of projecting something that's out here, but you're truly living out of your own divine spark, so to speak, yourself, however you want to call that. So the more you do that, you first have to move away, and that's what it feels like.
Yep.
Because the world you know has ended. And there is that sense of isolation, loneliness, and total distance because the world is so unfamiliar. But at the same time, you are coming near to them as never before because you truly are connecting to that part of yourself that now allows you to move authentically into the world in true connection.
I fine-tune it just a tad. What you come to is both you and, or you, let's put it this way. What you come to is both the personal and the collective self at the same time.
Exactly. It's not the fullness.
By finding out who you are, since the self is also what is everyone else shares, by coming into contact with yourself, you are put back in touch with humanity. I think that's what he's driving at.
Personal and transpersonal.
That the self is both personal and transpersonal at the same time.
Whereas before, when the God was totally projected out,
right,
there's, you have no relation. So all men, so to speak, and women are looking up at this thing here, but they're not connected here.
Right.
But once that image here just drops away, at first it feels like this voice is, how are we connected to this?
Yeah.
But if we can find that ourselves, then you see that we are.
Yeah.
And it's both personal and transpersonal.
And that's the show Mad Men is that, I mean, I think that's why, do you guys watch it? It's an amazing show because the writing is so, these are the most reprehensible people you could ever imagine, and yet everyone I know who watches it gets sucked in at a level like, it's unbelievable the way you get sucked into the show because the writing is so good that somehow you don't care that they're reprehensible because you understand that they're trying to figure out something. But it goes deeper than that because it, my husband thinks I'm just a little goofy, but I say, you know, this is really like Spirit of the Depth kind of stuff because we are, the show is set in the 60s, so it's far enough away from the people with whom the show is very popular that it doesn't really touch you, but it deals with all of these questions of who is your family? How are you connected? Who are you? If you do something that is different and you hide that, then can you become something new or are you forever haunted by what was? And how does that affect other people? And so it's really intriguing the way that all of this stuff is coming into being this little microcosm of an hour and it does, now it all makes sense. Before, it never made sense to me why I and everyone I know would want to watch these people doing really pretty horrible things to each other. But I think it's actually a way of understanding that shadow side of the culture.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, but what it made me think of was how in, I was living in a more collective place and trying to do all those things that I thought would help me to fit in and, you know, make me perfect. And then once I began to move out of that, what I had to come to accept was my humanness and that I was a part of humanity. I wasn't perfect. I wasn't going to be perfect. I was going to be human. And that maybe that was enough, you know, because in the other place, I was separating myself from humanity, and by coming to accepting my own place, I became more of a place where I could then begin to be a human being.
Yeah. So the irony is,
really,
the more you tried to fit in, the less related you were.
Right, right. So that in the end, it really, you know, it was a paradox because I moved further away on the collective level, but I felt closer to other people.
That's what he's trying to. That's the paradox he's trying to get at.
Yeah.
Exactly. How relationship is paradoxical. And then the last bit is incapacity, or you might say fragility, or humanness, or capacity to make a mistake, or the lack of perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that ending beanie.
Mm-hmm.
Plants are just themselves,
they don't
try to imitate.
Maybe that's it, yeah.
You know, and they just become themselves what they were meant to be.
What they meant to be.
They probably don't look at each other and say, well, my color's prettier than yours. And
what sorority were you in?
Yeah, right. And I have two more degrees than you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're probably in that BS. They just are.
Think of the scripture about the lilies of the field, or, you know, God clothes them, the birds of the air, they don't have to worry about what they're going to eat. They just do what they're doing when they're taking care of all of our security issues. And
but there's still, even with flowers, there's still something that's unknowable because if you look at a flower in ultraviolet light, we really don't recognize the flowers. Flowers are lots of things. So it's like there's something hidden underneath it. You can see them in different ways. Some are looking up, and some are looking down, and some are, you know, straightforward. But they all move towards the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And have roots down to the...
Mm-hmm.
The other thing always intrigues me about flowers is that they're actually very unbalanced, and there's usually an odd number of petals. They're asymmetrical, but they always look right. You know, they don't look and say, oh wow, look, there's three, it needs to be even.
Like the evenness and the perfectionism is more of a, it's not natural. You see a really even pattern. You know, it was
made ready. Right, and if you see a rose is absolutely perfect every petal, then you is that fake? You know, and you don't like it as much, even if it turns out to be real.
Well, that got us to 2:45 before Mysterium. And this wasn't even a difficult section. Wait till we get to the next one.
Well, I'm glad we're not perfect. We're not getting ahead really fast. Striving.
Speak for yourself.
Let's see. I just brought along to page 248 with me. What the section that's called instruction, what page does that end on?
251.
I want to read to the end of that instruction section. We probably won't get... I doubt whether we'll get any further than the beginning of the instruction section, but just in case we do. Because the next section is tough.
What page are we reading?
251.
251. Are we going to meet after May?
No, yeah, two more times.
Two more times, and then we won't meet in June at all.
We don't meet June, July, and August.
I know that's what it's been, but I'm just going
to... Yeah, that's what I'm assuming. Well, we need a break. I need a break. And then I'll figure out the schedule for the fall. So we have to probably reserve this room in advance. If you want to plan it yourself, just go every other week, and we'll probably start after Labor Day. So whatever the first Thursday is after Labor Day, on the alternative every other week schedule. We always have to go two weeks, because the room is in use the other weeks. Everybody care what you thought it would be, or?
Better.
Okay. Well, we'll keep on keeping on, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.